Episode
testing 1 2 60. Record levels looking good.
Six. Episode 66. Sometimes we look to Zamaza. 3, 2, 1.
KOKW calling. I'm on international frequency. Come in.
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
He's trying to cheat us, Pepe. All this talk is so he can get a better price, so he can make fools of us.
Yeah, it's so easy to make a fool of me. Why don't you try it sometime?
Well, I got something done. I got a job at Mr. Greenfeld's sporting goods store, and he promised to do anything he can to help me to get to Texas.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
I had a reason for inviting each guest. I wanted kind of a cross-section. They share one thing. They all need money. Now let's see if they're brave enough to earn it.
And you call this a party?
Could be.
Good evening to you, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to yet another edition of the Nighthawks podcast. And this is a special episode in a lot of different ways. Maybe not any one of them a huge deal. Well, one of them's a huge deal, but all adding up to a very special episode, I think. Matt, in the studio with me, as always, Mr. Matt Foster. How are you?
Sublime.
And that is actually a misnomer. Matt is not in the studio with me. He is actually in parts unknown in Utah. I am in central Wyoming, and where we are is in our conceptual Nighthawks diner, where we like to get together after hours and talk about movies. And we invite you to come and listen in on that conversation every week on the Nighthawks podcast. Matt, how have you been?
I'm golden. I've been Pony Boy. Been staying gold.
What have you been up to? What have you been watching? What have you been investing your hard-earned dollars in and partaking of in the narrative artistic realm?
I gotta say, Westworld's getting good.
Man, you know, I keep watching the first three episodes of Westworld, and I'm into it, I'm liking it, I like where it's going, and then I'll get distracted. And by the time I have time to go back and start again, I have to remind myself of what's happened and I have to watch those three episodes again. It's a vicious cycle that I've started on several TV shows that I need to break.
Just read a summary and then watch episode four. I watched a little something called Requiem on Netflix. It looks like it's a Netflix film, but I don't know if they picked it up or if they produced it, but it's a British thing, very strange, kind of about the kind of Celtic folklore, a woman that moves to an old house, and John Dee is involved, so you get some actual semi-grounded in air quotes reality of the real world occult. Kind of a spooky little thing. It's six episodes long, self-contained, one season of British television. I like that. I like that they keep it bite-sized.
Yeah. I stumbled onto Netflix, and it was one of those things that just kind of gets recommended at you. You know, Netflix has this very obtrusive way of just saying, hey, have you seen our latest original series? Netflix is coming out with so much content now that a lot of that is getting lost in the din for me. But one that did stand out, and I ended up watching it. I started one episode, was not intending to finish it, but it turned into one of those, I absolutely have to find out what happens next, binge to the end. Oh my God, it's 2 a.m. and I have to work the next day. I got turned on to Evil Genius, which is a true crime miniseries that came out on Netflix. Some people may remember this, and I was surprised that I didn't. Back in the early 2000s, there was the pizza bomber. And it was a guy who had robbed a bank, who had a bomb strapped around his neck, and he was a pizza driver. And there was a big mystery surrounding, who had put him up to it, who was in on the heist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
His claim was that some jigsaw-like figure had put the bomb on him and was forcing him to rob the bank.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That was his, at least what he promulgated initially, right?
Yeah. Have you caught the miniseries yet?
I have not.
I highly recommend it because even then, like, as I'm like, well, I don't really remember this happening, but I did remember parts of it. I remembered maybe some of the sensational news coverage and some of that, but it really does kind of take it beyond the superficial findings you might find on, say, like a Wikipedia or something. Now, what I will say is it's definitely a more subjective take. It becomes fairly evident by the end, and depending on where your threshold is for that on documentaries, might color how you feel about this. By the time this movie comes to an end, the documentarians, the filmmakers, the series as a whole kind of takes up a point of view. That can be a turnoff for some people, but unfortunately, that just seems to be the mode anymore. And especially with true crime documentaries like these, people don't seem to be satisfied with that real kind of dry Ken Burns-style talking head documentary. You know, they all have to be sensationalistic or something. You take a look at, say, the Lost Souls trilogy that HBO put out about the West Memphis Three. How weirdly the perspectives on those changed between the three different documentaries that were made at three different stages of this crime.
Okay, brief sidebar, what do you actually think about the West Memphis 3?
Honestly, I don't know. I definitely don't think the 3 did it. And even if the 3 did it, the legal case put forward was not sound. It's kind of like, you know, speaking of another like true crime documentary from Netflix, The Making of a Murderer. You know, whether or not you think Stephen Avery did it, it's just almost undeniable that the case was bungled and that the defense probably could have been stronger and that legally, from a sound legal ground, a not guilty plea was probably more appropriate. That may not necessarily mesh up with the facts, but you have to look at it from a legal standpoint. It's not necessarily did they or did they not do it. It's can they or can they not prove it. And so that's the weird kind of legal distinction that I think is hard for us to make as people out in the world, as community members and things like that. Yeah, it makes for interesting conversation, if nothing else.
My opinion about that is that the cops in that town were working off the logic of guilty of something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're like, we know this guy's shady. We're gonna pick one and run it up the flagpole. And they picked the wrong one and kind of put their foot in it. But we're tangenting.
We're not, actually. I mean, this kind of dovetails nicely into the major topic of our episode today, which is not true crime, although there are those that would argue that it does have some kind of basis in reality. But we decided this is one of the other reasons that this is a big deal episode. Not only are we joining up with the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network, and we're going to be able to start talking about that, but also, Matt, congratulations, buddy. It's been 3 years since we started this podcast, almost to the day. So congratulations. Happy 3-year anniversary. We skipped year 2, but we did have kind of a big deal first year anniversary episode. And I don't know that we're going to go that grand for this one, but we did want to do a special movie. And I think this is going to be a fun one. And so for this particular edition of the Nighthawks podcast, we tapped the master of suspense, one of the greatest directors of all time, Alfred Hitchcock, and his film Psycho from 1960.
Worth noting, Alfred Hitchcock is not related to Herbie Hancock. They have different last names.
So, Psycho, this is a classic movie, released in September of 1960. It stars Tony Perkins as Norman Bates. We've also got Janet Leigh as Marion Crane. We've got Vera Miles as Lila Crane. We've got John Gavin as Sam Loomis. We've got Martin Balsam as Milton Arbogast. Just a classic horror suspense film. And I think it's time that we just kind of crack it open and just feast ourselves on the gooey innards. Let's just say, Matt, so we're sitting around, we're in the Nighthawks Diner, we're having a slice of pie, we're having a cup of coffee, and we're not talking about any one movie in specific, but we are talking films. So that's your context. when we're talking about film and I say the word psycho, what comes to mind?
Oh, well, the music. The music and the stabby shower scene. The
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting that you key into that. Because I did notice this time through that I really enjoyed the score, not even just during that iconic scene, and we'll get to a synopsis in a moment. But the score here really is incredible. And it's one that I have caught myself, and I'm not a big classical music person. I don't generally listen to orchestral music as a hobby or as a field of interest. But this is one that I have loaded up from time to time, and it does what the movie does for me, which has given me a little electric, kind of suspenseful charge. And it's Bernard Herrmann, by the way, we should probably drop his name, is the guy who did this score. I think the score is essential and has almost kind of gone on to become its own thing. And it's interesting that you key into that one particular moment, because that's the thing that I think is everybody's first exposure to Psycho. The stabbing motion with the hand and then imitating that stabby score with your mouth. So you run around and you chase your friends. You've got a Lincoln log or a comb or something, and you're running around the house and you're stabbing at them going, wee, 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 wee.
Two completely random and in no way overly specific examples of things you might use when improvising the Psycho scene.
And so, I mean, I know I was doing that long before I ever saw the film. How about you, Matt? What was your first conscious exposure to Psycho?
Well, can I tell you something something dirty, something filthy?
Oh, yeah? Go ahead.
A secret from the bowels of my conscience.
All right. What have we got? Tell me what's going on.
This is the first time I have ever seen Psycho.
This is the first time you've ever seen Psycho?
Yeah. I've never watched the whole thing.
Wow. I had no idea. Well, congratulations. Well, Mazel tov.
Somebody had spoiled the ending for me, so.
Well, I'm sorry. I guess we should probably put that out there before we synopsize, is that this is a movie that trades heavily in a few what-a-twist kind of reveals, and we're going to be talking about those. So if by any chance you have not seen Psycho, and if by some chance, and I'm not going to say it's impossible because anything's possible, but if you don't know the story of Psycho, I need you, hang on just a second while I give you your instructions, then I need you to stop the episode immediately. First, I need you to get a hold of us. Because this is a question that I actually posed to Matt Matt, I wish I had known, is can you imagine watching this movie in context, having no idea what was coming, having no idea what it was about? If that's you and you want to do this and come on the show and tell us how this unfolds for you, we'd be very interested in talking to you. But otherwise, you're probably going to want to pick a different episode because we got to get granular on this one.
I mean, this was a huge commercial success at the time. I believe it made $50 for every dollar it cost.
But basically, what we're looking at, and this is your spoiler-filled synopsis, Psycho is the story of a woman who's kind of hard up on her luck. She's sleeping with a guy who is married. He doesn't particularly want to go through a divorce. He's not in good financial straits. He works at a hardware store in this small little podunk town. She's living in big city and she works for some kind of real estate business. And she's just generally dissatisfied with life. She's not a big fan of her job. She really wants to make things financially work so her boyfriend can divorce his wife and they can run off together. And she happens onto a delicious opportunity. A customer of this land management company comes in and wants to buy a parcel of land for his daughter. I believe it's for her wedding, and has quite unexpectedly brought the entire cash price for this ranch. The firm that's handling this kind of sale and this transfer of ownership, not super comfortable about it. And so they entrust this, I believe the number given is $40,000 in a small white envelope, and they give it to our main protagonist, Marion, who is played by Janet Leigh. And so Marion now has a huge amount of cash and a lot of temptation. And I wish I could tell you that this is the story about this woman wrestling with her decision to thieve a lot of money to finance her romance. And it almost is. But it is not that story. What we are given is this weird MacGuffin setup, and that's just to get our protagonist into a place where she's in peril. And so what we get after that is Marion, who is on the run from her own paranoia. She's on the run from her boss. She is on the run from not knowing what to do. She's very confused, finds herself in a bad storm. It's hard to see out the window. She takes the wrong turn on the highway and ends up at a small little out-of-the-way, know-nothing drive-up motel with its very peculiar owner, his mother, and 12 empty rooms.
Well, we're kind of talking our way around is that, and this was, I did, by the way, find a contemporary review of Psycho, and it is actually, it has some good pull quotes in it. We're sold that this is that this movie will feature this glamorous young lady throughout, and she's actually polished off fairly early in the film, in the infamous shower scene, which happens in her hotel room as the young proprietor of the hotel kind of stalks her.
We are led to believe that the proprietor of the hotel is this very henpecked, good-looking young man who is a little awkward and a little strange, and who has some dalliances of voyeurism, I guess, some kind of creepier voyeuristic tendencies. Upon discovery of this, we are led to believe that his mother, a very puritanical kind of iron fist type, decides to punish Janet Leigh's taking a shower while her son was peeping on her by savagely murdering her. And what follows the rest of the movie is we follow her lover, her sister, and a private investigator as they attempt to try and unravel exactly what happened at the Bates Motel the night that Marion checked in. We come to find out by the end of the film that Norman may not necessarily be the innocent, young, naive person we think he is, and that his mother is not necessarily the woman we think she is, because they are, in fact, one and the same. Norman has lost his grip on reality, and having been so dependent on his mother, has assumed her identity and assumed her role in a case of kind of split personality, as it was understood in the 60s. And Norman would often assume mannerisms, voice, dress, and behavior of his mother, which led to the death of this woman. So basically, the first thing is this movie breaks a lot of rules for a lot of different reasons. First and foremost, we're looking at Hitchcock, and we're looking at this film. It's important to contextualize that this film was made in 1960. This movie was in the middle of Hitchcock's peak career. The movie he had done just before this was North by Northwest, which was this big, grand, color, highly suspenseful, lots of action, lots of special effects and stunt work, big set pieces. The climax happens at Mount Rushmore. Like, this was a big movie. This was a big deal movie. This was the, Hitchcock's going to roll over in his grave for making the comparison, but let's say something on the order of a Mission Impossible or maybe Taken 1 when it first came out. Real phenomenon, lots of high dollar, high quality films made really well, big deal films. These are the movies that Hollywood loves because they're big grand spectacles and they pull in a lot of money. Well, Hitchcock scaled himself back and went from North by Northwest to this small-scale, very intimate, very in-your-face, very cheap black-and-white film that only has a handful of characters and no real major big-deal special effects. And so you look at something like, you know, we've talked about this before when Jon Favreau went from producing on the Avengers and directing the Iron Man franchise to making Chef.
I don't think that this was quite that. I think not that Favreau didn't believe in Chef as a project, but I think Hitchcock probably believed in Psycho commercially. Probably a script he liked, you know, an idea he liked. One thing that I think happened here, I feel like watching this in context of other movies from, you know, that small window in time, I have to muse that perhaps he accepted a smaller budget and a smaller scale to get a less censored film. This feels like kind of a, I don't want to say gritty, but this is a pretty pretty salacious film for the time. There's a lot of bare backs. There's some tummy creepy stuff on behalf of Norman and his mother. Some stuff goes down by implication that is pretty, I think it's about as much as you could probably get away with showing in something that got a real wide small town release, you know? So I wonder if that was a factor in him just shrugging about the budget and going, we can make it work. Now, I don't know. You've read more about the background of the actual, you know more for a fact about the production than I do in my head. So you tell me if I'm off base.
You know, it's funny that you bring that up, Matt, because the actual production on this, there's a lot of controversy surrounding that. So I don't know that there's any one definitive source on how this movie happened, what Hitchcock's motivations are. He was interviewed pretty extensively himself, but it also depends on what you believe of him. It depends on what you believe at, you know, at one point. People allege that Saul Bass, who did a lot of the animated opening credit sequences for Alfred Hitchcock, directed the shower scene. And there are others that say that Saul Bass denied that. There are some who say that Janet Leigh was used in the shower scene. There were some who say it was a body double. There's a lot going on here, and I don't know that we're going to have a ton of time to kind of parse the odd theories and conspiracy theories with this. But that is something that exists with this movie, is it's almost been picked apart to a Stanley Kubrick Room 237 level of people who have really just picked this apart and followed the DNA lines into other movies, figured out where it came from and where Hitchcock kind of got his feet wet in other movies that would then lead to this moment. We'll get to it at the end of the episode. There's a documentary called 7852, which is alluding to the 78 setups and 52 cuts in the shower scene. And I believe the subtitle of the documentary is Hitchcock's Shower Scene, where a group of filmmakers of varying, you've got the guy who directed Dust Till Dawn 2, Texas Blood Money, and then you've also got Elijah Wood and his friends at Spectrovision, and then you've got Guillermo del Toro giving his hot take on it. And it's really just this super granular digestion of this one scene and kind of the things that feed into it, some of the moments that lead up to it, and then a very, very microscopic view of this one scene. Some of them talk about the different allegories they pull from it. Richard Stanley specifically, to kind of come back around to answer your question, Matt, Richard Stanley, who directed Hardware, and was kind of notoriously kicked off a production of The Island of Dr. Moreau, talks about how Psycho was kind of the giant middle finger that he believes Hitchcock was giving the Hollywood studio system by going in there and subverting all these tropes and breaking all these rules and making a movie the way it's not supposed to be made. And there is a violence to this. You talked about how this is kind of about as extreme as you could get with a movie and still have it be released and commercially viable. And I think that's true. We were talking a little bit off mic. There is an apocryphal story that talks about, at the time, it was the Hays Code that they were submitting to, and they were kind of the overseeing body that regulated content that could be in films. Hitchcock had submitted Psycho to the Hays Code, and they had sent some notes back. You need to trim this. You need to do this. You need to do this. And Hitchcock said, well, why don't you all come back and you can watch me reshoot them? The day came for the reshoots. The Hays office never showed up. Hitchcock said, what the hell with it? Have a good day. And submitted the original footage and got it passed. But this was a very subversive movie. This was a movie that did not play by the rules. And I think it was all done intentionally. It was not a sloppily made movie. Hitchcock did not make sloppy movies. It was definitely one where he was testing the limits and he was being a little more experimental, which would be harder to get a larger budget for. So I don't know, Matt, that you were entirely off base. I have not particularly read the scholarly roots to back that up. But Your guess would be my guess as well.
What got me for this, what kind of sucked me in, often I'm mentioning something as the exception that proves the rule, almost to the point that my expectations have been countered more than they've been met. But this is a pretty contemporary feeling plot and pace.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice lean movie where something is happening the whole time.
Well, and I think the timelessness of Psycho is really what kind of makes it lionized in the culture. For the first thing, this is the first time we ever saw something like this on screen. Like I said, Hitchcock was breaking a lot of tropes. Among them, we're killing off our protagonist in the first, what is it, the first third of the movie? We are, we've got a toilet shown on camera flushing for the first time in cinema history. And it's a major plot point, so it's not something they could easily get rid of. We had some pretty bold nudity, I guess. I mean, nothing that you would be seeing in Playboy magazine, but enough that it was a little titillating. It was a little hot, especially for the time. Just breaking a lot of these weird tropes, and even to the degree of in that granular analysis of the shower scene, they talk about breaking the stage line, or what other people would call breaking the 180 rule, and jump cuts and things that you are just plain not supposed to do in film. Hitchcock realized that those were tropes, and those were something that we as the audience had gotten comfortable with. In using those and using them almost imperceptibly, he was able to create a sense of unease in the audience and a sense of suspense, which is what ostensibly Hitchcock was famous for. There's a story told in the documentary, and it's something that Hitchcock was relaying himself through archival footage. But he's talking about if you sit, and I'm paraphrasing here, but if you sit, characters
four down. People are sitting around a table talking about baseball, whatever you like. 5 minutes of it, very dull. Suddenly, a bomb goes off, blows the people to smithereens. What do the audience have? 10 seconds of shock. Now take the same scene and tell the audience there is a bomb under that table and will go off in 5 minutes. Well, the whole emotion of the audience is totally different because you've given them that information that in 5 minutes' time, that bomb will go off. Now the conversation about baseball becomes very vital because they're saying to you, don't be ridiculous, stop talking about baseball, there's a bomb under there. You've got the audience working.
And so in a weird way, he kind of pulls both in this movie, in that we think we're following the one story. We're following the story about embezzlement and thievery and a woman who's in over her head. And then we literally, quite literally on screen, throw all of that into a car, throw it in the swamp, bury it, and it becomes this movie about a guy who is trying to hide his mother's crimes. From that point on, you realize that there is something sinister going on, and now that the investigators are showing up, it's this kind of good potboiler, you know?
What I guess that I didn't have a sense of is the degree to which this was kind of a dragnet closing in movie. It actually kind of, the sheriff reminded me a bit of Hank in Breaking Bad, where you underestimate him at first, and then the private detective, I should say.
Yeah, Arbogast.
Where he reminded me a bit of Hank in Breaking Bad, where he seemed like he wasn't going to be that effectual, and then he turned out to be rather bulldogish. I liked watching all that unravel, and then I also liked some of the stuff that happens is refreshing, like Marion's lover. When the authorities show up, he just kind of shrugs and goes, yeah, we gotta find out what's going on here. He doesn't do he doesn't try to completely silence the whole thing. He's not, which is refreshing to not have him go completely heel and be like, I don't, if she's dead, I don't want to hear nothing about it. I don't want to, you know,
yeah.
She's just my mistress. Their relationship turning out to be somewhat validated as loving and thus against type for adultery was kind of interesting. The film style here was very, I think you nailed it with the claustrophobia. What we have to kind of circle back to is Perkins' performance.
Oh, Perkins is fantastic in this movie.
He's so simultaneously awkward and kind of winning that you're like, dude, you could just go straight. You don't have to be a psycho killer. Just be cool. That aspect kind of has to be there. That's the difference between movie serial killers and serial killers, is because all of our movie serial killers, we tend to in media dial in on those qualities that could be used, I won't say redeemed, but could be used in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you get your Lecter, especially your Mads Mikkelsen Lecter, the younger Hannibal.
Yeah.
And then I think it's why, in Mindhunter, they dwell so much on guys like Kemper that are a bit more articulate. They don't devote as much screen time to like the Jerry Brudoses of the world.
Well, what you're talking about is like the difference between like a Gary Ridgway, somebody like that, versus like Charles Manson, who's more of a raving lunatic.
Like a BTK versus someone that Richard Speck, where there's like clear differences in how articulate they were, how much they planned, how organized versus disorganized they were. We find and make celebrities out of the special cut of killer because there's an air of superiority to them in their media depictions. Fascinates me because, I mean, real serial killers are human garbage. And I don't just mean that because they're murderers. I mean, they're usually kind of just trash people too. Sorry if you guys are listening.
We don't mean to offend any serial killers that might be listening right now. Hashtag I am not Paul Avery.
Ted Cruz, if you're out there, just confess, bro. But yeah, I kind of think what I'm coming around to in my circular way is that I think this is kind of the genesis of that. Predates Ed Bundy, or Al Bundy, Ed Kemper, Ted Bundy.
Ed Harris.
Oh, I should take Ted Bundy, Ed Kemper, and Ed Gein and make Ted, Ed, and Eddie poster. That's dark. But this may have been kind of the origin of the idea of the kind of gorgeous, duplicitous, handsome young man who's also a mentally fractured killer.
What actually came to my mind, and it's not something that you can trace back to its original roots, but if you go back to, say, the old classic Universal Monsters, Dracula, where the monster is this very kind of aristocratic, good-looking, and even the scene where I think it's Renfield and Dracula in the original Dracula film where he sits down and Renfield is eating and Dracula says, oh, I have dined earlier. And there's almost a scene that mirrors that in Psycho where Norman Bates is saying he's prepared this kind of hasty dinner for his lodger. And she makes the comment, she's like, oh, but you're not eating it.
You're very kind.
It's all for you. I'm not hungry. Go ahead. You eat like a bird.
You know, of course.
No, not really. Anyway, I hear the expression "eats like a bird." It is really a falsity, because birds really eat a tremendous lot. But I don't really know anything about birds. My hobby is stuffing things. You know, taxidermy. And I guess I'd just rather stuff birds because I hate the look of beasts when they're stuffed. You know, foxes and chimps. Some people even stuff dogs and cats, but oh, I can't do that. I think only birds look well stuffed because they're kind of passive to begin with.
It's a strange hobby. Curious.
Uncommon, too.
Oh, I imagine so.
And it's not as expensive as you'd think. It's cheap, really. You know, needles, thread, sawdust. The chemicals are the only thing that cost anything.
A man should have a hobby.
Well, it's more than a hobby. A hobby's supposed to pass the time, not fill it.
Is your time so empty?
No. Well, I run the office and tend the cabins and grounds and do little errands for my mother, the ones she allows I might be capable of doing.
Do you go out with friends?
Well, a boy's best friend is his mother.
And it's kind of that spider leading the insect into the web with the, you know, the glistening dew, or, you know, an anglerfish bringing the prey in. Honestly, what happens here is Hitchcock, acutely in this film, really makes the audience complicit in what's going on screen. He really puts the audience in a position. He really brings the audience into the narrative. There's lots of shots in this movie where characters are looking directly into the camera, almost indictful of the audience. You've got a very likable protagonist in Janet Leigh's character. Even though she's doing some stuff that is a little under the table and a little underboard, you can't help but hope that she's going to eventually make the right decision and do right by herself, or at least do right by her company, or do right by her lover, something. You're hoping for a happy ending for her. If you're watching this movie cold, and that's something that we have to kind of take as an academic exercise, this movie is so ingrained in pop culture, it's kind of hard to hit it cold. If you're looking at this through the context that you don't know that Norman is what he is, when you first meet him, he's likable. You kind of root for him. He's this kind of, aw, shucks, good-looking, super awkward guy who, you know, if only his mother wasn't so oppressive, might just actually hit it off with Janet Leigh and they ride off into the sunset with $40,000. I don't know. But up until the shower scene, you're really kind of pulling for everybody here. And you like Norman. You like Marion. And then all of a sudden, the whole thing just comes crashing down and is totally upset, and you realize that you've been paying attention to the wrong movie. You've been paying attention to the wrong story. Now, where that gets interesting is that we, as an audience who has had, how many years has it been since 1960 that's been?
Don't think about it.
This movie is nearly 60 years old and has informed every other movie of its kind since then. People like us who have grown up knowing the tropes of this movie before we know the movie, we can't watch it that way. We know what Norman is. We know the twists and turns in this movie. But what I have to point out on this rewatch, and this has been a rewatch after multiple rewatches, is that this movie still works. You still like Marion. You still like Norman. You can't help but hope that this time around, they'll get it right. And it's because you as an audience are so invested. It goes back to that conversation about the bomb under the table. We know what's coming, so it becomes suspenseful for us to see the small little reveals that Hitchcock puts in. However, to have watched this cold, to be an audience in 1960 watching this for the first time, to throw back to something that's going on now, you've seen the viral marketing for Marvel movies and how Thanos demands silence and please don't talk about spoilers in the movie. Hitchcock did that with Psycho. There was the announcements played. You'd hear Hitchcock's voice go, "Nobody will be seated after the picture begins, and please do not spoil it for others." And it was really important that people could hit this cold for as long as they did, because there were nobody going to hit it cold once it got into the zeitgeist. But even when you don't hit it cold, there's still plenty there to build that suspense and that tension. And this movie has almost infinite rewatchability.
It manages the feat of you get double invested, because after one build and release, then you get another entire set of protagonists that you begin to feel attached to by the middle of the movie. So, I mean, that's remarkable to me that, like, they pull that switcheroo so successful.
And, you know, a lot of that was Hitchcock. He was a master of suspense. He was a fantastic film director. And as I mentioned, many consider him the greatest filmmaker ever to have lived. But we can't sell short either that these performances are all really solid. Specifically and especially from Anthony Perkins as Norman Bates and Janet Leigh as Marion. When Marion is driving in the car and they use the trope of kind of playing out conversations in her head as she thinks they're going to come out as her crime is discovered, gives her a moment to shine as an actress as she plays out these emotions in her mind and is trying to figure things out. And you see her run through these scenarios in her head, even though you are hearing the dialogue audibly. It gives her a chance to react and to really emote and be an actress there. And that also has kind of the double effect of it also serves as a loose narration of things that we're not going to see and serves as almost exposition for things that are happening off camera. In that we have an expert storyteller, Alfred Hitchcock, and an accomplished actress just giving us these moments, these scenes in this movie are just, you peel one layer away and there's another layer there. It's like an onion to throw back to Shrek. And there's so much to unbox here that it's really fun on a rewatch, and it's really fun to watch from an academic angle. And it's really fun to get super granular with documentaries like 7852.
I think one of the most interesting pieces of characterization here is ultimately she decides she's going to turn around and give the money back. And even one of the clues that later gives away that she was, in fact, not where Norman said she was, is she sits down and does the math of how much she's already spent on a, because she buys a car. That whole scene we didn't even touch on where she swaps her car off, which is a really weird, oddly tense scene where she attracts the attention of a cop. So she's trading out cars in a hurry. She forgets her luggage, and the guy from the car lot chases her down, tries to get her to do a test drive. She doesn't want to. She just wants the car. That's still basically the prologue. And you really get a sense of her, that she's going to go on a roll, you know. But I think her deciding to give the money back is key, because that lets her tip the domino and then walk back her arc. So this ceases to be an exploitation or punishment arc where she's a lost person. It's very important that she had that. She becomes innocent again before she's killed. It's what makes this kind of this is sort of the prototype of your Hills Have Eyes, crazy rural people subgenre, because it's what puts this takes the 1 foot off of suspense and puts it 1 foot into horror, because it gives him that characteristic of a horror antagonist where he is a weather event. Or what our friend of the pod, Patrick, would call weather-like events. That change in agency for Norman, or for Norma, at the time you still should believe it's the mother. But then the other thing is that also tells you Norman's motives for covering up the crime. And it makes it very clear that he's never really going to leave.
If you haven't figured it out by now, and if you're still listening despite our warnings, is that Norman's mother and Norman are the same person. It's a very Fight Club kind of take on it.
The framing of it, they never show Norma. So there's never a female actress playing Norma. You see a few peripheral shots of what is... And I don't know if it was a stunt player or if it was Anthony Perkins.
It was, at least in the shower scene, it was a stunt player.
But you see some carefully shrouded figure, you know, and I also did like on a small progressive for its time shout out. They do stop to point out during the investigation of Norman Bates that he has multiple personalities and believes he is his mother, that he's not a transvestite.
Yeah.
Or transgender. They draw that distinction that this is not something a consenting adult is doing for gratification, that it's a psychosis he has where he believes he's someone else. You know, and that's a frequent, because the guy in a dress is such a punchline, and it's
Right. And, you know, they easily could have gone down that road. I mean, this movie was made in 1960. Attitudes towards transvestites were not good at the time. They still aren't.
Yeah. And that's a shame, because transvestitism is awesome. It's very breathable.
Well, luckily, we've made enough progress now that, you know, RuPaul can make a TV show out of it.
And like a dutiful son, covered up all traces of the crime he was convinced his mother had committed.
Why was he dressed like that?
He's a transvestite.
Not exactly. A man who dresses in women's clothing in order to achieve a sexual change or satisfaction is a transvestite. But in Norman's case, he was simply doing everything possible to keep alive the illusion of his mother being alive. And when reality came too close, when danger or desire threatened that illusion, he'd dress up, even to a cheap wig he bought. He'd walk about the house, sit in her chair, speak in her voice. He tried to be his mother.
Well, one thing I did want to bring up, and this will tie in a little bit, is that Psycho is based on a novel by Robert Bloch, and it is a short enough read that I managed to squeeze in an Audible listen between yesterday and today. It's only about 5 hours Audible. If you're actually sitting down to read it, it should be even less than that, depending on your relative reading speed. That is something that I noticed actually even came from the novel, is that they were very sure to point out that Norman Bates was not a transvestite, that he was a multiple personality sufferer, and that transvestites do not typically do things like this, which, again, for a novel or a movie in this time and place, was shockingly prescient.
I don't know, man. It's so weird anyway. Like, how come two tubes around your body is okay, but one big tube isn't? unless you're Scottish or a priest, and you can wear yoga pants as a woman, but not as a man, unless you're John Cena. And then not only can you wear tights in public, you are the most manly man for doing so. It's alarmingly fluid.
Yeah, it really is. Some other things when we're talking book-to-movie translation. In the book, Norman Bates is not a strapping, good-looking 20-something. He is actually kind of an old and schlubby. I think he is actually given the age of 40. Kind of balding, bespectacled, kind of dumpy guy, which I thought was an interesting change, because you do get a little hint of maybe not something that they're going to indulge, maybe not something that they're going to work on, but there was a little bit of sexual tension, sexual chemistry going on during the early parts of the conversation that Norman has with Marion. Now, part of the tension that builds in that scene is how creepy he gets. And especially in a modern context, I think that comes off better. But it was definitely there, and I don't know that it was there in the book.
Well, you almost see him, you almost see like a through line where she's treating him a bit more like he's younger yet.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's so winning that she sort of lets him into her room, like he's a high school boy that's helping her with her luggage. And then she gets in an enclosed space with him. And it gets kind of claustrophobic and weird, and she realizes, like, oh, no, this is a grown-ass person that lives out in the hills alone, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that I think adjusting Perkins's age did, by all rights, Norman Bates' mother in the movie should be 45 or 50. If he's 40, then his mother would be in her 60s, and it's a different level of plausibility. With young Norman, the veneer that Norma is up there sick in bed is kind of thinner. Like some specific ailment would have had to befallen her to make her bedridden in her late 40s. I don't know how old he was really supposed to be. I suppose he could have been as old as 30, but that definitely for me made it hinkier from the get-go. And so much of, like, it is a plot point that Norman has loud arguments with Norma that passersby overhear. And it makes that feel and seem a little more staged, which I think is important, that those dialogues be stilted and weird so that you question who Norman is and what he's doing and what's going on up in the house. That helped with the suspense. I say this a lot, like, adaption is an art. And most of what I see was adapted here was either to keep the movie more bottled up or to help with the audiovisual suspense.
You know, and I'm going to agree with you, Matt, because what I'll say is that while the movie works really good on a rewatch and still works good if you're very familiar with the movie, the way that things unfold in the novel are not nearly as accessible on a multiple occasion, or if you know what you're doing going in. They do some interesting things where they play around with the narration and the point of view, where sometimes you're following Norman as a protagonist and sometimes you're following somebody else. And they play a little bit about the timeline and how things unfold, and they build suspense that way. And in that way, I'm not going to say it's expertly handled, but it was interesting. However, knowing what I knew going in about the story, I was able to kind of see things being telegraphed that maybe would have come off as more of a clever nod or some clever foreshadowing if this novel was not nearly didn't end up being the story and pop culture juggernaut that it ended up becoming. One of the things I do enjoy about Norman, And especially if you just take the movie as is, if you don't factor in the book, if you don't factor in the multiple other times that this property has been visited, if you just take the Hitchcock film on its own, really Norman's motivations are very broad strokes. You understand that he was probably psychologically abused by his mother. You understand that he is psychologically sick. And you understand that through some kind of conflict between those two things, he lashes out violently. But you really do not get a granular, he was raised and abused and sexually abused, and then his mother was carrying on a sexual relationship. A lot of it is implied. And so none of it is entirely definitive. And part of that is because, yeah, they had to get around the Hays Code, and you can't just come right out and say that Norma Bates was having an extramarital affair with this other guy. You have to imply it. You have to give the audience the impression without just coming out and saying that they were shtupping each other. Another reason that works, however, is that it makes Norman's, his motivations, really ambiguous. It just kind of leaves that question in your mind. And when you don't know, H.P. Lovecraft said it best when he said that the oldest and greatest fear that mankind has ever known is fear of the unknown. And when you don't know, it makes it so much more real. We look at horror movies before this, and it's usually a monster. It's usually an outside force. It's an alien creature from the stars. It's a werewolf. It is some hokey monster that does not really exist coming after people that are sort of relatable. This is one of the first movies that ever said, this is some shit that can happen to you. Just in the same way that Marianne has no idea what's happening or why it happened, when it happens, the audience is still going to be a little in the dark about a few things. Now, what's happened since then is that this property exploded, and after Hitchcock died, they made three sequels. Robert Bloch wrote two sequels to the book, which have nothing to do to the produced sequels to the movie. I believe Psycho 4 was in and of itself more of a prequel. And then you also have the Bates Motel series that just wrapped up on A&E, which is kind of a backstory. And I guess I have not watched Bates Motel, but by the end kind of gets around to a retelling, readaptation of this story. On top of that, in what was it, 1997, 98, somewhere around there, you had Gus Van Sant do a shot-for-shot remake of Psycho that didn't work, but that also, just through kind of weird implicit things, gave Norman Bates more of a backstory and gave him more of a motivation. You know, as a matter of fact, I'm just going to come out and say it. During the scene where he's peering through the wall in his little peephole and watching, in this case, it's Anne Heche playing Marion, take a shower, he is audibly masturbating, which just strips it of being anything creepy. It's just gross at that point. And then there were some lingering shots towards the end of the movie of Norman's quarters, and it's just filled to the brim with pornography, which just really, to me, makes him feel like a pervert.
It also ruins the reveal, which they probably weren't concerned with.
Yeah.
If you're going to change things like that, then it's not shot for shot anymore, you know?
Well, and there are a few little extras, and they go through this in the documentary. They actually had some of the Gus Van Sant crew in. Now, I don't know how much of this was just selective soundbite taking, or maybe they are just now comfortable enough to say how they really feel about this movie. But I can't remember who it is, and I have to apologize, but it was somebody who worked on the film, and they included one shot that Hitchcock had allegedly shot, but was deemed too revealing and was cut from the final film. They included that in the Gus Van Sant version, and I have to say, apologies to Anne Heche, because they really don't leave anything of her up to the imagination in this shot. And I don't think it was necessary, and they even say in the documentary that it doesn't work, and that the shower scene as a whole doesn't work. Now, I'm going to expand upon that and say, for me, subjectively, this whole remake was just a bad idea from the word go. If you're just going to take a movie and just remake it shot for shot, what's the point?
Why not just exhibit the original?
Exactly. And, you know, it was the 90s. It was a weird time. We were playing around with revisiting stuff. That was, you know, we were in the heyday of the episode one and the special editions. Like, this was a weird experiment, and it just fell flat. But now, I've mentioned this on the show before. But my first exposure to Psycho was the Universal Backlot tour when I was a young boy. My parents had taken me out for a theme park adventure out in Southern California. I think I was 11 or 12 at the time. And by far, our favorite theme park on our visit out there, with apologies to Disney, was Universal Studios. Part of their backlot tour is that the Norman Bates house still stands. It's been moved a couple of times, and to my understanding, is mostly just a facade. There's not like a functional house inside, but the actual exterior of the house still exists on the Universal backlot, and they drive the tram by it. But the last time I went to Universal Studios, which has been about 4 years ago now, they actually had actors come out and play as Norman Bates putting a body into a car, and it was kind of neat. But when I saw that back when I was 12, the building itself cuts such an imposing figure, just the house, the Norman Bates house, that I was instantly captivated by it. I had never seen Psycho at that point. I don't even know if I had heard about it. And like I said, I was knowledgeable about, you know, the stabbing motion and the score. I knew elements of Psycho, but I did not know the film itself. And that was one of the ones that my mom instantly brought me back home, hit the video store, rented, and said, "This is why I don't like taking showers." And for a 12-year-old kid who at the time was not really interested in anything that was not a comedy and was not interested in anything black and white, Psycho grabbed me. Now, I kind of knew the backstory because my mom had told me a little bit about it, but it was still a really effective movie, and the shower scene in specific, pretty brutal and pretty haunting for a scene that really doesn't show you anything and leaves a lot of it to the imagination.
To tell you the truth, not looking feels so characteristic for Norman. Like, you feel like Norman is the kind of guy, and this is a serial killer thing, that you're the kind of guy that would kill someone, but then cover their prescriptive anatomy. He's the kind of guy, he would try to be a supreme gentleman even while stabbing you.
Well, exactly. So something that was happening, it was the year before, it was 1959, and that's a year before the movie came out, was the Clutter murders in Holcomb, Kansas, which is what In Cold Blood is based on, the Truman Capote book. And that's a situation where, after brutally killing these people, they took the two killers took it upon themselves to kind of, in a funerary manner, cover the faces of these fallen people, which is something that confounded the investigators. They said, well, if they murdered them so brutally, why would they take the care to cover their faces? And so, yeah, you're right. That is something that happens, and I see where you're coming from. And because Norman is a split personality, there's probably the fact that it's his mother doing the stabbing and Norman is closing his eyes while it happens, trying to put it out of his mind.
Well, and the other thing is the Norma personality may not be terribly interested in the lurid element of the naked lady.
Right. Well, and that's something that is strongly hinted at, is that, you know, the naked female form is really why she's lashing out.
Her interest in the nudity is punishing Norman for dallying with the woman.
Right.
I really think the delicacy of the final cut, where it's just a little bit here and there. I mean, it's certainly nothing by a modern, you know, Eli Roth, Lars von Trier world. Certainly anything to write home about, but it's just right. It's perfect for the characterization in the script. I don't know if they decided, they found a way to make it work for them, or if they pushed it exactly as far as they wanted to and let their own taste rule them, but they came out with something very, very functional that suited what's going on. There's also something about, like, afterward, when she's slouched over with her cheek on the tile.
Oh, God, yeah. Whew.
She's not smashed into it in a way that makes you go, whoa, dang. She's not cut and bleeding from the face. He doesn't hit her repeatedly in the head or anything. Like, it's not like the Rob Zombie Halloween sewing machine attack in the bathroom. It's not realistic violence per se, but there's something about the fact that they took an actual woman and put her in a position where no person would actually want to, like, lay there very long, and took a long still shot of it, that it really is, I mean, kind of hypnotic.
What's happening in that scene is we see a vague circular shape, kind of towards maybe just a little off center of the screen, in several different shots in that sequence. It's the point of view of the showerhead. It's the point of view of the peephole that Norman is looking through, and we, by proxy, are from his point of view. Counterbalancing Janet Leigh's point of view in the shower that we also get. We also have the circular sink or the circular bathtub drain as blood is pouring out. And then it culminates in that circular eye. And the camera does this, well, and it's not the camera, but the film does this funny maneuver where it kind of spirals around her face and then pulls back. Well, what we have to realize that at the time, that is actually pretty expert, tricky filmmaking because the cameras at the time were not going to be able to pull a maneuver like that. You're looking at cameras in this day and age as being larger than a man and probably heavier. That sequence was done optically where they actually took the still footage from the scene and shot it with a camera and turned that still image and then blended it into the shot that pulls back. Just the amount of artistry that that took for something that we can now pull off with our video phone in about 5 minutes is something that we really have to remember. And that's why I think this movie is such a good go back for giant film nerds. We're kind of coming up on the if then portion of the show, but if you are interested in filmmaking, if you like Psycho, 7852 is going to be a really fun watch for you. However, it is also super nerdy. This is getting into the real granular text and the real grit of filmmaking. And so if you're just a casual fan, it might be a little dense. It might be a little academic. But, you know, there's a lot of good filmmaking happening in this movie. And on top of just being a crowd-pleasing narrative, it is also a technical marvel.
Yeah, I don't know. What else has some nutty camera work for the day? And I still haven't figured out how they shot all of Gravity, but they had computers for that. Where does the if-then go here? I mean, you can go into the horror, into things like The Hitcher or The Hills Have Eyes, where you have more of that lonely Southwest.
Well, I just actually like to call back to our Monstoberfest episode last year when we covered a double feature of Halloween and Friday the 13th. And I think even in that episode mentioned that the progenitor of the modern slasher movie is probably Psycho, and how a lot of the tropes that were set up and have become almost comical now and almost heavy-handed were established in this movie. And even though those tropes are heavy-handed and we do see them coming a mile away in modern horror now, somehow still function with this movie.
I think with more of the POV, Black Christmas comes to mind.
Mm-hmm. Another very early slasher film.
As something where you have the eavesdropping voyeuristic element.
Well, and this is a good introduction just to Alfred Hitchcock in general.
Oh, yeah. I think Rope comes to mind.
You know, I put out a little survey. This was just among my personal Facebook friends, but I just threw it out there. What is your favorite Alfred Hitchcock movie? And by and large, the same ones hit the top of everybody's list. Probably the top two were Vertigo and Rear Window. I have to say that, honestly, my favorite Hitchcock movie depends on which one I've watched the most recently. So in this case, it would be Psycho. But Psycho was a strong contender in there, although I think it was definitely less than those other two. And surprisingly, and this is the one that I always just assumed would not play for modern audiences because it has not aged well as far as effects go. But the other one that kept coming up was The Birds, which is it's an adaptation of a short story by Daphne du Maurier, and it's about the day that the birds decide they're sick of our shit and revolt. Like I said, the special effects have not held up to contemporary standards particularly well, but I guess that movie, and it's been a long time since I've seen The Birds. That was actually probably my first Hitchcock movie. It was the first one my mom showed me, but I haven't seen it in a long time, and I think it might be time for a rewatch because that keyed in with a lot of people. Like, that still works for a lot of people, which is a pleasant surprise on my part.
I almost feel like there was more direction then, like movies were made less by committee.
Because mm-hmm.
Like another one, I found myself comparing it to 12 Angry Men because of the claustrophobia you mentioned.
Right.
Which is a very deliberate choice of style. And I think that's why even even people we don't necessarily love, like James Wan or the Blumhouse movies, they have a distinction to them that was maybe getting lost for a while. And so now we're getting back to a little bit like, let a guy make a movie. I don't know. I'm just kind of spitballing.
No, I think that's important. I think that is, I don't know, from the outside looking in, you know, where I'm sitting from my armchair in central Wyoming, which is probably about the furthest you can get from the pulse of what's going on in filmmaking in Hollywood, does seem like we're getting a little more auteur control. Now, that being said, any film that you make is going to be a collaborative effort. Saul Bass did do the storyboards for the shower scene in Psycho, and they followed them very closely. So by that rationale, and the rationale that got Frank Miller co-director credit on Sin City, yeah, he probably had a big hand in that. But also, it was done under the direction of Alfred Hitchcock, who had the grander idea. You've got Anthony Perkins bringing his particular interpretation of a role. You've got Alfred Hitchcock ultimately overseeing that, but it's still going to be within what Anthony Perkins is capable of and what he is able to deliver. Same with Janet Leigh. And so movies will always be a collaborative thing. However, where the problem comes in is when a studio who is not looking at it from an artistic perspective says, yeah, but it'll make more money if we do it this way. Now, that's not an entirely illegitimate mindset. The studio is the one putting up the money for this film, and if it doesn't make money back, that's bad business.
The recent challenges we've seen to that, like we're definitely in an era where we're seeing the biggest studio movies we've ever seen,
mm-hmm.
but we're also in an era where we're seeing some things challenged. Like I just went to Deadpool 2, and there's a supporting character in it called Domino, and she burgles every scene she's in, and the word of mouth on it is already like go to this to see Deadpool, but also go to it to see this person that should probably have her own show, movie, spinoff. And or the actress should get more work. And so every challenge we've seen where we like the recent Star Wars movies where they're like, here are some people that maybe look like the rest of the planet. Here are some people that, you know, they yield a little screen time, that we're not always panning across the same rock hard jaw and the same uniquely pretty people over and over again. For a while, we lived under the tyranny of the bankable star, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now it's almost like we're running through those people. We've put them, if they're not Tom Cruise and running out of steam, then they're in the Avengers. right? And all the other movies have to break new people. And that is one thing I've always loved historically about Star Wars movies is they get blanks and they give you someone to project onto a little bit. And then after that movie, they're not anymore. You know, and so there's something about the king-making that goes on in that franchise that I think is really interesting. Oh, I did have a quirky observation before we sum up.
What's that?
One thing I loved about his performance is it's almost like the killing tops him off throughout the rest of the movie, and you see it in what I'm told is an improvisation that he eats candy all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Once he does the one murder, it seems like his appetites are growing. They show him eating more. They show him drinking more. They show him being a little less neat and tidy. And you can almost see that something's been tipped, and the clock's ticking until he does it again.
Well, and I'll tell you, the one that really just nailed it home for me is when it's him and Marion, and they're sitting in the parlor and they're having dinner. And this is a good scene in the book too, because Marion, in a lot of ways, reminds me a lot of people I know. They're the young, kind of exuberant, effervescent people who are maybe just a little naive or maybe a little willfully naive, who look at a person like Norman Bates and maybe doesn't fully contextualize just how much they've bought in. And so they're like, well, what about life outside of this hotel that you've known for 30 years? You know, why don't you just put your mother in an institution and go live your life? Why don't you find a nice girl, settle down, and get married? Which is a conversation I've had with several people. Granted, it ended a lot better for me and them than it did for Marion and Norman Bates. But there is a palpable change when you can tell that Marion has pushed the issue too far.
I understand. I don't hate her. I hate what she's become. I hate the illness.
Wouldn't it be better if you put her someplace?
You mean an institution? A madhouse? People always call a madhouse someplace, don't they? Put her in someplace.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean it to sound uncaring.
What do you know about caring? Have you ever seen the inside of one of those places? The laughing and the tears. And the cruel eyes studying you. My mother there.
And suddenly we go from awkward, aw shucks, kind of stammering, uncomfortable, awkward, but still kind of boyishly handsome. He's not weird, he's cute. But the second she says that, he sits forward and his mannerisms change and he becomes much more direct. And that's the first hint that we get that something's going on. And that's the moment where I think, as a modern audience, especially one who is hyper aware of feminism and how women are treated these days, that's when it starts getting really uncomfortable. It's literally just him sitting forward and being a little more authoritative. Just, it so works. It so works. As we wrap things up, you know, we usually play the game, you know, should this be remade? It almost seems like a moot point here because this has been remade. It's been remade recently. It's been remade on television even more recently than that. It's been sequelized. The novels have been sequelized. Matt, do you have any kind of, like, I'm not asking you if we should remake this because that question's already been answered, but
I would give this my highest vintage movie endorsement. If you can catch this in a theater,
yeah,
because I think this should be seen big and tall if possible. What an oddly formative movie! Like this movie, you can see a lot of DNA here.
Mm-hmm, for sure, and that's why I think we're having such a hard time in the if then section, because almost every movie that has anything to do with horror or suspense after 1960 takes something from this movie.
Well, and almost an entire subgenre of things that are very allegedly ripped from the headlines, but very loosely, which was a device we saw in the marketing for this and also the marketing for Texas Chainsaw, which followed not too long after this. Actually, I guess that's not true. 12 years.
Yeah.
Here, let me read a little from this vintage review, if I'm not cutting you off.
Yeah, go ahead.
Psycho from Jack Harrison. Originally published June 17, 1960. Bottom line, this is the plug line that where he kind of sums it up. Paramount won't let anyone enter theaters where Psycho is playing after the picture starts. Don't worry, no one will want to leave before it is over.
Huh.
So he endorses it heavily. So the great filmic talents of Alfred Hitchcock, his artistry, technical mastery, skill, and planning are very much in evidence in Psycho. This is a first-rate mystery thriller full of visual shocks and surprises heightened by the melodramatic realism of the production. And he points out, film opens with a typical Hitchcock touch, a long, slow pan over the town of Phoenix. Main story is laid against the background of an isolated motel and adjoining eerie mansion. As in all Hitchcock films, the camera effects and explorations are a vital and exciting element. There are two murders on camera and innumerable others referred to, including a matricide. One of the murders, that of Janet Lee, takes place while she's taking a shower.
Spoilers!
And there is enough blood on screen to satisfy the most bloodthirsty movies fans. He actually does do a spoiler kind of disclaimer, but I skipped it. Anthony Perkins gives by far the best performance of his career, which this was not a breakthrough for him, actually. He was in several things, including, I think, an Oscar nod, a nomination, or no, it was a Cannes Best Actor, before he did this. So he'd been in three or four things. This is Anthony Perkins gives the best performance of his career in the title role. That's kind of a spoiler right there. Maybe it's not cricket to give away the ending. There's an old idiom.
Yeah.
But since hardly anyone plays cricket and since the picture's playing here, you might as well know that Perkins' psychotic split has him. Oh, he gives the whole thing away.
Aww.
Bad form, sir.
Ooh.
Oh, his name should be stricken from all the obelisks. That does bring to light that there was some kind of guerrilla marketing for it, that they did some of the old, you buy the whole seat but only need the edge. That's quite interesting.
You know, and one of these days we'll have to sit down and talk about William Castle, a contemporary and, depending on who you ask, a friendly professional rival of Alfred Hitchcock, who was a little more into the gimmick side of things, but that's a story for another time.
He was the guy that did The Tingler?
Yeah, he did The Tingler. He did the original House on Haunted Hill. It really fascinating, and allegedly, according to his own autobiography, was arrested for prostitution in the city of Cheyenne, Wyoming. But again, that's a story for a different day.
Oh, I wonder if you can still find that police report.
Well, according to his tell, and keep in mind, this is Castle here, so take everything he says with a grain of salt. But apparently he befriended the sheriff, who did not formally charge him, and they went and partied that night.
Yeah, that's good hookering to get away with that. You know, one we've got to do at some point is Cecil B. DeMented.
Yeah, that'd be a good one.
We've yet to cover any John Waters.
Yeah, we need to get John Waters in here.
Yeah, we do need to get him in here. Call him.
He might just do it.
Yeah.
So, Matt, your first time through on Psycho, wrap this up for me.
I'm going to say there are a few things that you know, as a listener, you know if you can handle old school filmmaking. Like, there's some dolly shots that jutter. There's some process shots when they're driving. Put that aside if you can and understand that that's the tools they had, that there's a jutter in the dolly shot because a guy had to roll it on a box. On an absolute scale of every movie ever made, I'd put this one, I'd give it someone in the 80s.
Yeah?
I'd go high 80s. 80. I'm going to give it an 89.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I might even go high. I might actually give it a comfortable 90.
You're going over by 1 point like it's a showcase showdown?
$1, Bob.
I love it when somebody does that. That's just such a, such a move, you know, just like I'm the alpha male of the showcase showdown. I'm going to go a dollar over.
$421, Drew.
So what's our next step here, Trevor?
Well, our next step is you and I are going to be in beautiful Salt Lake City, Utah on June 8th at 7:30 at Club 50 West. That, again, 7:30 on June 8th. We will be joining the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network. We are really excited about this, guys. Really looking forward to it. Hopefully it's going to give us the opportunity to maybe bring in a few guests, a few co-podcasters. I think some really good things are in store. In the meantime, happy 3-year anniversary, Matt, and happy 3-year anniversary to our listeners at home, some of which I know for a fact have been listening since the very first episode. So our hats off to y'all. Thanks for sticking with us. And we hope to just keep on chugling and bringing you some coffee and conversation.
Oh, hey, Trevor, I found out something kind of sexy.
What's that?
The 3rd anniversary is leather.
Oh, my. I'll have to see if I can find us a little something-something for when I make it to Central Utah.
Sounds, I can't think of any good leather puns. I'll something-something skin of my teeth, because leather is skin. I'm making it weird.
In the meantime, because of our partnership, we recognize that we might have a few more new listeners. So if you're new to the podcast, welcome. Be sure to find us on iTunes or Stitcher or the podcast app or aggregate of your choice. And when you're there, it'd be doing us a huge solid if you leave us a review, leave us a rating, and subscribe. Matt, am I forgetting anything?
I'm sure you're forgetting something, but I think that's the podcast handled. All right, everybody out there in movie commentary audio land, where we talk and using sound waves about things that are visual, thanks for listening, and we've got to go because it's almost morning.
Well, the murderer, you see, crept in here very slowly. Of course, the shower was on. There was no sound. And